You can go ahead and open your Bibles to Luke chapter 2, where we will pick up the Word of God in just a little bit. I want to set the background to the story a little bit more. You know that I've been working on this chronology with you, that I believe Jesus was born in the spring of 7 BC. And I've talked about a few of the things that have brought me to that conclusion. First of all, the sixth month when Gabriel appears to Mary, in my estimation, means the sixth month of the Jewish year, which means that Jesus would be born 9 months later, which would put that somewhere in the second Jewish month of the following year. We know that the cycle for the priests started at a certain time back in history. And if you follow it through in the year 8 BC, the priestly division of Abijah, the division of Zechariah, would have been on duty in February of that year. And if you go forward 6 months from that time period, that brings you to basically the sixth month of the Jewish year. When Mary became pregnant and made the visit to Elizabeth, who was in her sixth month of pregnancy. So that kind of matches. We also know that there are Roman records of a regular census that was ordered of all Roman citizens by Augustus Caesar in the year 8 BC. More than likely, that began in the summertime of 8 and would have continued for quite some time because you just can't instantly count everyone in one day. And so we also know that sometimes these Roman citizen censuses were then followed up by censuses of the larger portion of the population of the empire, because the information was used to make the assessments of how much revenue each area needed to bring in. And so it was typically left to the various client kingdoms to use their own procedures in making their census, collecting the information of all taxpayers and what the expectation was that they would be able to contribute to the overall funding of the Roman Republic slash Empire. And we know that the Bible story of Jesus' birth is framed around Joseph coming back to his hometown of Bethlehem in order to register for that very purpose, so that his income expectations could be added in to all of the other information that was going to be sent off to Rome. Now, a couple of other things that I want us to have in the background here is that we know that King Herod is in his 60s, second half of his 60s, and he is a very powerful person, but he has got problems with fighting amongst his heirs. Now, not physical fighting, but rather trying to vie with one another as to which one is going to be the eventual king of the Jews. And we had seen some historical events where the oldest son, named Antipater, who was not born when Herod became king. He was born before, so he wasn't counted as a royal offspring. He had been really trying his best to get rid of his two younger half-siblings that are the sons of Princess Mariamne, and therefore are of the royal Hasmonean line. And he had manipulated all sorts of things to the point that Herod eventually puts these two young boys on trial. And guess what? That happened early in 7 BC. So while Mary and Joseph are kind of waiting for her pregnancy to progress to the point where Jesus will be born, these are the things that are happening in the world of Herod. His two princely sons, Alexander, who was 28, and Aristobulus, who was 24, were tried in absentia, meaning they were not even allowed to be at the trial themselves, at Beirut, up on the Mediterranean coastline in Syria. And Herod had them condemned. Herod is about 67. And then after they were condemned, he had them executed. And that left Antipater, who was 39 or so at this time, as the apparent heir for this crown once Herod is gone. But Antipater knows that he is not popular with the majority of the people in Judaism, the majority of people living inside the Herodian kingdom of the Jews. He also knows that the military hierarchy, they don't like him either. So he immediately starts doing what he can to drive a wedge of relationship between his father and all his other half-siblings, his half-brothers. And I want to go through the list of them so that you can start thinking about some of the more famous ones of them being in the story now. There was Herod II, also known as Philip. He was about 20 years of age. He's the son of Mariamne II, not the Mariamne the princess. Then there is Herod, who's 17. He's the son of Cleopatra of Jerusalem. Then there's Herod Archelaus, who comes into our Bible story later. He is currently 16, and he's the son of Malathras, the Samaritan. Then we have Herod Philip, who is 15 years of age, and he is the son of Cleopatra of Jerusalem. And then we have Herod Antipas, who is 13. He is also the son of Malathras, the Samaritan woman. And this is Herod Antipas that comes into our Bible story about the trial of Jesus and then the other stories in the book of Acts as well. All right, so those guys are all pretty young, but their older half-brother, Antipater, is doing his best to make sure none of them become his rival. Well, Herod is apparently aware of this, and he will eventually send his eldest boy back to Rome. And when he does, he sends with him his will to be kept on deposit there, because the executor of his will be Augustus Caesar, because they're such close friends. There is also something that I want to highlight again here at this point. This continued goodwill between the Roman leadership and Herod the Great, and therefore the Jewish people. And so there are Jewish special religious protections offered by the highest rank member of Roman society, and that is Augustus Caesar. And I want to read to you from Antiquities. This is Josephus's writings, Antiquities 16, chapter number 6. And it says, Caesar Augustus, high priest and tribune of the people, ordains thus: since the nation of the Jews have been found grateful to the Roman people, not only at this time, but in times past also. Let me break in and remind you, the Romans and the Jews have been allies since the days of Judas Maccabee. In 160 BC, they entered into a special treaty arrangement of mutual assistance. And so that treaty has been re-upped over and over and over again since then. So Augustus is not kidding when he says they've been in this special relationship since times past. And chiefly Hyrcanus, the high priest, under my father, Julius Caesar, the emperor, it seemed good to me and my counselors, according to the sentence and oath of the people of Rome, that the Jews have liberty to make use of their own customs according to the law of their forefathers, as they made use of them under Hyrcanus, the high priest of Almighty God, and that their sacred money be not touched, but be sent to Jerusalem, and that it be committed to the care of the receivers at Jerusalem. So let me break in again. What the emperor, Augustus Caesar, is putting down in official writing here is that the Jewish people are guaranteed that the money they send off to the temple is inviolate. It can't be touched. It is God's money. And no one has a right to that other than God. And then he goes on and says this, and that they not be obliged to go before any judge on the Sabbath day, nor on the day of the preparation to it, after the ninth hour. So the rule that he makes across his empire is this: because the Jewish people take the Sabbath day off, they can't be forced to show up at courts on the Sabbath day. In fact, they can't be required to come to court after 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the day before the Sabbath, the day of preparation, which we would call Friday. And then it says, but if any be caught stealing their holy books or their sacred money, whether it be out of a synagogue or a public school, now let me break in again here, he is citing here the knowledge of there being public Jewish schools. And this is another one of the indicators of how high the society of the Jewish people were at this time. Everyone, pretty much, was taught how to read and write and do ciphers, you know, arithmetic and things of that nature. And so the public schools generally were associated with the synagogue buildings. And so he's basically saying anyone that steals any object from the synagogue buildings or the associated public school buildings, quote, he shall be deemed a sacrilegious person, and his goods shall be brought into the public treasury of the Romans. So that would be sacrilege against the Jewish religion, and the penalty would be to have all of your finances taken away and absorbed into the Roman treasury. Continuing. And I give order that the testimonial which I have given you on account of my regard to that piety which I exercise toward all mankind, and out of regard for Caius Marcus Censorius, together with the present decree, be proposed in that most eminent place which has been consecrated to me by the community of Asia at Ankara. And if anyone transgresses any part of the above decreed, he shall be severely punished. So on pain of punishment by the Roman Empire, the Jewish people are to be treated with great respect regarding their religion and their religious activities. And so that's another reason why I keep emphasizing the relationship between Rome and the Jewish people was not like what you see portrayed in so many of the fictional materials that are out there. It was actually a pretty good relationship, and it was one which protected the Jewish faith under Roman law. And so please adjust your mindset and your thinking about how things were in the time of Jesus' birth. And then we have something else that I want you to be aware of that might contribute to the story of Jesus' birth. Do you remember that when Augustus was declared to be kind of the emperor of the Roman Empire, and he actually had the name Augustus given to him by the Roman Senate, his friend Herod immediately started naming things after him and doing things in his honor. And one of the big things that he did at the very beginning was that he declared that every 5 years, which, by the way, the Roman Senate gave grants of this emperor power to Augustus in 5 year increments. So that's probably why Herod did this. So every 5 years, Herod honored his friend with games at Jerusalem. And remember, he built a whole bunch of new venues, theaters and amphitheaters and hippodromes. He invited people, contenders from all over the Roman world, to come and to compete for prizes. It was like the Olympics, only bigger. And this is one of the ways that the Jewish people became very prominent in the Roman world, is because these Augustus games were happening every 5 years at Jerusalem. Well, guess what? 7 BC, the Augustus games were scheduled to occur, probably during the summer, which means that the competitors and those that were wanting to come and be spectators would have started arriving in the late spring, right around the same time that Jesus was born. And you remember, his parents couldn't find room in the inn and had to go elsewhere for the birth of the baby. So that might have been a contributing factor. And not only the Augustus games were due in 7 BC, but you remember that when Herod built his brand new man-made harbor at Caesarea, named in honor of Kaiser or Caesar, he declared that every 5 years thereafter, there would be Kaiser games or Caesar games at the city of Caesarea on the coast at the harbor. And so those were also due to occur in 7 BC. And so Jerusalem and Caesarea were both probably jam-packed with competitors and spectators from around the known world in the spring when Jesus was born. And I just find that fascinating, that that's part of the background. All right, and then you know, of course, the five-year census is occurring, which is where we take, the 20-year census is taking place, which is where we now pick up our story in Luke chapter 2, verse number 1. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. Now, some of our Bibles will say taxed, and then you've got these fictionalized accounts that have the people showing up and having to empty their pockets out or empty their bags of coins out because they were paying money to these tax collectors. And of course, again, this is one of the things that kind of irritates me as a Bible historian. Is that they try to portray this all being enforced by an occupation Roman military that's standing there threatening people if they don't empty their pockets of all this money. Well, that's not how this all happened. All that's happening is an assessment is being done over the entire Roman world to find out, what sort of job does every adult male engage in, and what is his anticipated income for that year? And then all of that information is going to be collated and sent off to Rome, and based on that, a tax expectation will be sent back to places like Judea under King Herod. And King Herod will be basically assigned a certain amount of money that he has to get from his people in taxes in order to support all the larger things that the Roman world is doing. And that's not just military operations, although that's part of it. But there will also be infrastructure operations, such as all of the aqueduct systems and the road systems, all the normal things the taxes are collected for. And so picture this being just simply paperwork. And so verse number two. Now, I've got to redo the wording of this because I have never seen yet. Well, no, I take that back. There is one English translation that I've seen. It's not a very famous one that I think treats the wording here properly. And this is the way it should read. This is the registration previous to that one when Quirinius was governor of Syria. Now, the reason that that is important is because the reference is to an event that takes place in AD 6. And so some people have been confused by thinking that Luke doesn't know what he's talking about because he's referencing something that happened in AD 6 when clearly Jesus was born while King Herod was still alive and Herod died in 4 BC. And so they will make claims that this is a contradiction or this is an error and proves that the Bible is not inspired. And the problem is they just didn't translate in English the word properly. The word first in the English Standard Version is in this context much more properly translated as previous. So this is meaning the registration in 8 BC and 7 BC was the one previous to the more famous one that took place when Quirinius was governor. Now, let me explain real quick what that was about. Archelaus, the son of Herod the Great, will eventually become the ethnarch of the Jewish people after his father's death in 4 BC. And he will be atrocious. I mean, he's only a teenager, or a young man, so it's not surprising that he's such a bad administrator. But he also seems to be kind of vindictive and mean. And so after he has been in charge for about 11 years, which brings us to AD 6, he is so bad and has made everybody so mad that he gets removed from office. And as often happens when you have this sudden removal of an administrator from office for maladministration, an immediate assessment is done of the records of that kingdom. And so Quirinius was the man who was serving as legate of Syria in AD 6. So he and the new procurator of Judea go down and go through the records of the Judean people and even do an assessment, have everybody show up and give an accounting of, you know, what's your job, what's your expectation for annual income, things of that nature. And some of the Jewish people were angry about the idea that things are being changed from a king of the Herod line into a Roman procurator at Judea, at Jerusalem, that they decided to rebel against this idea of direct Roman control. And so they insisted everybody should refuse to report. Don't cooperate. Don't let them know what your job is or what your annual expectation of income is. And there was some fighting about this. Judas the Galilean is the famous individual that is mentioned in all these stories. And so that's why Luke makes reference, because most people would be familiar with the AD 6 event, but he's saying, no, this is the one previous to that one, meaning the one back when Augustus Caesar was doing a census of the world. So basically 8 BC going into 7 BC. All right, so verse number 3 tells us of the logistics of this. All went to be registered, each to his own town. And I take that to mean birth town. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David. Now, we don't know exactly what brought Joseph north into Galilee. My suspicion is job opportunity for his father and perhaps even for himself, because they worked in carpentry work or construction work. And there was a lot of that going on up in Galilee at this time. Apparently, King Herod had decided the way he was going to follow through with this census, this accounting procedure in his kingdom, was just have everybody go back to their birth city and report there, because that's where their birth record was. It's convenient. The Jewish people are highly mobile. I mean, they go to Jerusalem three times a year in order to go to the festival. And there's plenty of Roman roads and things of that nature. So traveling is not that big of a deal for the Jewish people. So Joseph goes to Bethlehem, verse 5, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child. Now, she's mentioned here as being betrothed, but I think that the wedding has already taken place. The reason betrothed is still being used by Luke is because they have not yet consummated their marriage vows. Because, as we've already read, Joseph keeps her as a virgin until she gives birth to the firstborn son, and that would be Jesus. So we have pretty much run out of time today. We will have to kind of mark our place here in Luke 2:6 and come back tomorrow. So read ahead and let's get excited about the next part of God's story of Jesus coming.